Vacant buildable lands, 9 October.
All right, now we can start.
Good morning, commissioners. Oliver Ojako, Platinum Committee Planning Director. What we'll do this morning is present the basics of the vacant buildable lands model to the board and those in the public that we work with, and how far, get into a conversation of how far we've come and how we use the model. This is a continuation of a series of work sessions that the board will be having with staff as we gear up for the police system plan update. So this is, I'm not looking for any direction or decision from the board today. This is going to be informational tutorial, help you understand how we use the model. And this is a model that was developed since before 1994. We have been working with it. It was developed in conjunction with the building industry and the environmental community. And we have been working with it, making some changes as new information becomes available. So what I will do is turn it over to Bob, then maintain the model even though we use it in planning. So I'll turn it over to Bob to just walk through the in and outs of the model and how it is used for predicting what is available. And sometimes we use it to be able to determine capacity going forward. And then we have Bob go over there and ask you. This is, the information will be available on our website after the presentation. It's 30 megabytes. You didn't really want to make copies today, but we'll post it on our website.
Well, all right, Oliver, thank you. So this is, as Oliver said, I'm going to do a presentation on how the vacant buildable land model works. As Oliver suggested, it's something I've been working on for 20 years. I came here in 1992, and this was one of the first projects I started working on. I continue to work on it because it's just been something that's interesting and it's actually fairly complicated. So for this presentation, we've kind of gone through the model and looked at the data, and I think it's a pretty interesting presentation that you'll get. First of all, we'll kind of go over the model in more terms, and then we'll dig back through some of the history and kind of learn how it works. The vacant buildable lands model is really just a component of the planning that Oliver does. All we do is measure the acres of developable land in the county, just that rough number of acres. And it's based on a formula that, as Oliver said again, has been agreed upon by the cities, the county, and the community, with many meetings like this where we talk about the problems with the model, how do we make it work better, and we'll go over that. And it's also one of the things to remember, as I've always said, is the model is based on bad data. It's the best available data. And through time, we've improved the quality of our data to try and improve the quality of the model. And we'll go through some of that, too. It's basically based on a lot of GIS map layers and the assessor and treasurer records. It's actually three models. There's one for residential, one for commercial, and one for industrial. And the source of these classifications is our comprehensive plan map. The comprehensive plan has 50 designations, which we need to jam into these three classifications. So if we look at the city of Battleground and look at their comprehensive plan, a couple things to note. You can see that over here in the legend that there's a low-density residential, medium-density residential, which starts with the apartments, and then we have this notion of mixed use, which is commercial with residential, and we have a notion of mixed-use residential, mixed-use employment. So a lot of the vacant lands model are these shades of gray that we need to draw a line and say you're in commercial or you're in residential. We switch there, we can see that's a big chunk of residential mixed use. And where does that go, in the residential model or the commercial model? Another oddball that I found in Battleground as I went through there is someone grabbed one of these rural resource classifications for airport and stuck it inside the urban growth boundary. That doesn't go into any model. Somebody needs to say what model it goes in. Until then, it sits out there as an unknown. We also have parks and open space, which do not go into any model, so they're up there in green. So with that in mind, here's how we jam all those things together into our three classifications. And yellow is residential, commercial is red, and industrial is blue. And then we that the parks are in green. So that's kind of the basis for where we start, which model things go into. And like we say, it's the vacant buildable lands model. So what is vacant? Well, in residential, that means building value less than 13,000, and commercial and industrial is building value less than $67,000. Pretty straightforward. Those numbers have been set in stone since, I think, 2002. Those are going to be some pretty old numbers if you want to talk about what's vacant and what's not. So if we take that same yellow map, the same map we started with before, here's all the pieces of land that meet that criteria for vacant. So we could be done here, but there's another notion of vacant land, and that's the underutilized property. And that's, again, these shades of gray. You go from vacant to, you know, mansion and condo, and someplace in the middle in there is underutilized where the land can't. It's a larger parcel with a structure, and we could subdivide it. We've really struggled with this one over time. And we've settled with the notion of what we call the building value per acre, or BVA, which is the building value divided by the number of acres. And in residential, it has to be a minimum lot size of 1 acre before it can be underutilized. And we settled on the bottom 20th percentile of the building value per acre. And that was at $260,000 in 2013. That seemed like may seem like a big number, but if you take an acre of property and subdivide it into four, five, six houses, then you're going to see that building value per acre when it's developed. That's not really a big number. When you look at the industrial and commercial one, that's a pretty low number, 50,000. And that one's set in stone right now. And the building value less than 50,000 on the commercial industrial, those ones are a challenge with some of the assessors departments, the way they do stuff, but it really strives to get the barns and houses out in the rural area to at least, if we say they're going to be built, get them to show up as buildable. And again, if we look at this, we can see the most of the, here's the underutilized, and the red is the commercial, and the yellow is residential, and you can see it's coming up on the fringes, and that's what we want to see, that the barns and farms and stuff, they're not showing up as vacant, but they do have potential for development. So if we put in the vacant and the underutilized, now we have six classifications. And again, they're yellow, and darker yellow, and for residential. I try and make the lighter colors, the more developable ones, and the darker ones start to have some. They're going to develop slower because underutilized is not as choice as vacant. So the next thing we want to look at, well, what is the built classifications? And we really don't look at built. There's a big chunk of built undifferentiated. We don't really care. But over time, we found things in the vacant model that we said, you know what, this should be built. So there are types of built that we have teased out. And these are like easements and parks and private open space and courtyards. It used to show up in the model as developable, and we wanted them out of the model. So there are some built classifications. But we generally just show them as gray. They're built. And the parks, again, is one of those classifications we always show because they always are kind of an interesting one to model. And they are green. Now the next thing, this just gives us the basic land that's buildable and vacant. We do say that these lands develop at different rates. We say that vacant lands will develop faster than underutilized lands. Some lands will never develop. And a larger portion of the underutilized lands will never develop compared to the vacant lands. We also say that environmental constraints will further limit development potential of both types of vacant and underutilized. So from there, let's take a look at the environmental constraints which limit the development on the vacant and underutilized land. Now, environmental constraints are steep slopes, landslide areas, riparian areas, which are those areas next to streams, and floodplains and wetlands and habitat and species. Now these things don't necessarily stop development, but they can limit it. If we look at Battleground, it's got a lot of critical. And you can see there has a lot of built in the critical areas, perhaps more in the past than currently, but we do have a lot of critical stuff. If we continue with our theme of making things darker that are less developable and lighter or more developable, we now have 12 classifications with the different darknesses. And we're starting to get a pretty busy map, but you can start to see those themes on there. Now what I'd like to do now is let's collapse this down to the vacant and underutilized into a single vacant classification. We know that some of the land's going to develop slower than others, but for visualization, it's much easier to just show these as the three main classifications. And with that, then, I'm going to overlay the environmental classification on top of that. So we do actually end up with the darker ones showing the critical areas. And this works really well with the visualization. And again, seeing this, we can see the dark gray areas are built areas that happen on environmentally constrained land. So this does happen. They do drop out of the model. We also see, and what I like about battleground is if you look over here, we have an area where a lot of parks start showing up in the underutilized or the critical areas. They drop out of the model, they drop into parks and open space, they drop into wetland mitigation. It may not be built as houses, but it does drop out of the model. So with that, we're kind of set. We can start looking at the model through time, which is really, I think, one of the cooler things that we get to do here. And to go over the map one more time, this is this boundary here in black that we've got around the perimeter here. This is the 2013 urban growth boundary for Battleground. So in 1996, the battle was way back into the colored areas. And you can also see there's not a lot of development. As we step through time, you can see the gray areas year by year starting to kind of eat away at the vacant and underutilized lands that we have. And sure enough, as we get to 2004, a lot of the lands have been consumed. That's when we did our first plan revision. That's when we first pushed out our boundary. So in 2004, we adopted that plan. And in 2005, more lands were added inside the battleground urban growth area. So you have some more vacant lands. One of these things to notice about this big addition is a lot more of it was mixed use and some residential, but we really start to see a lot more mixed use starting to show up. Then 6 and 7, more development. Then 2007, we adopted another plan and pushed out the boundaries to their current limit. And you can see there, again, we added a lot of mixed use and a lot of residential. You also notice down the southern part of the area here, there's some vacant land showing up outside the urban growth boundary. That's one of these removal areas where the state said that those lands were unacceptable for being in the urban growth plan, so they got removed. So they kind of sit outside there. And as we move forward in 2009 and 2010, those lands dropped out. They were removed. You also notice something else happened between 2009 and 2010. You see a lot of this mixed use in the southern part switching back to residential, which we'll see that creates some interesting challenges with the model. We're changing comprehensive plan designations between model changes. And you can move on to 2012 and 2013. So that shows us how the model works over time. It shows you our data. It kind of makes sense seeing the land get developed. We can overlay this on our maps and compare the validity of it, and we think it's pretty good. So we go back and forth. We can see a lot has happened in 20 years. A lot of the land that we originally had has been developed, and we've added a lot more land to Battleground. And Battleground's pretty representative of the county as a whole, of all the cities I found when I went through this. So one of the things about model runs and how we do them, I apologize for this being technical, but I wanted to give you some more terms you might see. One of the things for us to run a model is we have a year, and that determines the assessor year, and the assessment data that we use, and the parcel layer that we use. We also have the urban growth boundary, which we've seen how that comes and goes, and then the comprehensive plan. These are the main drivers. Now, when we run a model, we've actually given them funny names. In 1994, we landed on the final name being the model P. We started with A, we ended with P. Yes, we did 17 or 14 different alternatives before we landed there. Same thing happened in 2004 when we got to J. And we did 2007, we started with J and ended with D. They're arbitrary names, but you do see them, and that's kind of what we call them in lieu of a better name. So with that then, we can say, instead of looking at this at a map, let's look at it in a chart form. And we can again see the underutilized, this is residential gross acres for Battleground through time. And we can see the underutilized portion in purple, and then here constrained with critical, and then just plain underutilized in green, vacant and strange in red, and vacant in blue. And down here you see those wacky names for the models. They got dumped into here. So that's 96P. And then you see that'll change to the 2005J when we switch to the 2004 plan. And then the B1's kind of current. What's interesting about this is you do see we had the original plan, and as the land develops, it gets this constant trend down. 2005, we added some more and starts down. 2008 jumped up again. Then we have another jump here for some reason. These mid-plan jumps are comprehensive plan changes. And we'll go more into that and kind of mask some of the stuff. There were no comprehensive plan changes from the first plan, so you get a really nice pattern there. And this starts to get masked as we start changing the comprehensive plan. So again, here's that shows the two breaks, the two changes, or adopted urban growth boundaries that we did in 2004 and 2007. So with that, you know, I kind of wanted to show there's the changes and what's happening. And sure enough, we see the changes here jump on the map between 7 and 8. And we can see the big changes in residential. If we switch to commercial, it gets a little more interesting. We see a huge jump in the 2004 plan because we had a lot of commercial, a lot of mixed use. We did that again in 2008. We also see a huge drop here between 9 and 10, which we're going to say is those changes in comprehensive plan designation. And we also have this red up here, which is the amount that was removed by the state that they said was unacceptable. So again, if we look at that, we can see the changes in 2004, 2005. We're focusing on red this time, right? And we see a couple things. We see existing areas of residential were turned to red. Actually, we saw existing industrial, this blue area here, right, gets turned to red. So not only do we add land, we change the classification. So that's going to make that chart seem a little weird. It's not that trend that we had early on when the comprehensive plan was more stable. And this causes a drop in the residential and the industrial, in addition to raising commercial. So now look at the 7 to 9 series, and we see that other big change because of the expansion. And we see a lot of mixed use was added again. And those are the big mixed use areas that were added in 2009 or the 7 plan. If we move on to industrial, we kind of see the same trend, where you see the decline, you see the big change in the comprehensive plan. Changes here caused a big drop in industrial, which would be kind of counterintuitive. And then just regular development, and then the changes again for the comprehensive plan changes. Battleground has a pretty simple industrial area. It's just that one big blue area of town. We talked about how it turned red from the 2004 plan, so that took a big chunk out of it.
Bob, can you explain how, so between, well, in the 2007 plan, we changed how we labeled constrained. You know, we used to use just a percentage of infrastructure,
right.
A percentage that is taken away if it is constrained. And then we started going to this model that actually looks at truly what is on the ground. So can you explain what we used to do and what we do now?
Absolutely. I will get to that.
You will. Okay.
Getting terms down and
see
the model, and then I will
get to
this.
All right. I just want to make sure we get that.
Absolutely.
Good.
So we're just watching the industrial, the blue area here. We want to watch the industrial through time. We want to see, as we go through here, we want to see the changes that are happening in the graph. We see a big change here between 9 and 10 and a big change between 11 and 12. We kind of step through and see that. We saw the change in 5, 8. If you're looking for the changes here, there's a comprehensive change plan down here, down in the south, where we added actually more industrial. That's the big change to industrial. So now we can take that same process and run that through a countywide time series. And what's interesting is the countywide numbers look very similar to the ones for Battleground. We can see the 2004-05 plan and the 2007-08 plan. Then we did see a big jump in the residential more for the 7-8 change than for the 4-5 change. We look at commercial jobs, we see in 2004 we added a lot of jobs land. And then in 2007, again, we added more jobs land. And then you also see an interesting thing, you start to see those removal areas. There are two removal areas. There's one here that you can barely see, and there's one here. That's because the LeCenter area came out later than the Battleground and Clark County removals. And if you look at the industrial, most of the land that came out in the removals is clearly industrial. And you can see the 2004 plan, we lost a lot of industrial. We added some back 2007 and 8. What's interesting here, I was trying to figure out how I fit these removals in, because I thought the removals, I would see a bigger drop and the removal would bring it back up. And what happens is you have the removal overlaid on top of the comprehensive plan changes, so it makes the charts very confusing. And what I want to show you is how much we're changing those comprehensive plan designations. So this is the Vancouver vacant lands model in 2009. And there it is in 10. You can see, I put some circles on that. Down here is a big chunk of industrial that went away. There's another one here. So you can see that changes the amount of industrial just with those comprehensive plan changes. So looking at that, then I said, well, let's combine all this stuff. That should take away a lot of that noise, and certainly it does. So those changes, this is countywide, all the vacant buildable lands, by the industrial in blue, commercial in red and yellow. You can see it's much more gradual decline. So I put those in there. Then you get the increase from the UGA boundary change, gradual decline, increase, gradual decline. And you even see with the 2007 and 8 one, the big drop here is not so much development, but that is as a result of removal. And here, again, the big drop here is because of removal. And this is one of the things that I have to a little frustrated with. When we did this, we basically rerun all of our models using our historical model engine to make sure everything was on the same sheet of music. And 2013 is actually not a historical model, it's actual. And we found this difference here looks like it's really more difference between how our historical model behaves versus the year to year. And we'll fix that. We'll go back and fix the historical model, but I don't think that represents a big chunk of development at this time. So the next thing is, do we get these gross acres? And then from that, we start to do deductions. And the deductions are, there's some land we say we'll never convert. I call it residual. We say there's the environmental constraints. And the amount we deduct varies from 0 to 50%. We have infrastructure, which is another deduction. The mixed use one's a little weirder, because half the land goes into the residential and half goes into commercial. So those aren't really deductions, they're just split. So if we look at all those gross acres that we got from Battleground for residential, now when we start to do those deductions we've talked about, you can see it's split out by the different comprehensive plan designation for the mixed use employment. And we can see the bigger chunk of this is in the commercial market, commercial model. This little green piece is actually the only amount of acres that gets considered as going to have houses on it. And you can see as we move down, some of these underutilized ones that are constrained, you have huge deductions because we say that the critical lands don't develop much. We also see a lot of infrastructure requirements that reduce it, which gives us the actual developable net acres that we get to figure out how many houses per acre that go on that. This is a graphic way to see that. You see, even though we have a ton of underutilized constrained lands in the model, it really doesn't yield much buildable land. So this is the yield report. This is a report that we've had for years now that really shows the math of converting the gross acres to the net acres. And what's nice about it, this is just a portion of it. It goes on for quite a while. but it does show you this all about how we do our math. So you can see that commercial residential split that we took of 130. That doesn't even show up, but we only took 60% of those acres. There's where you see the critical deduction is 50%. The residual is 10%, or that just will not convert. And then we have the housing units per acre. So from this, you can go from your gross acres all the way to here's how many housing units that we're going to get from that land. And that's kind of, those are, a lot of those assumptions are up to the board and the development community. It's not part of the model. That's what we do with those gross acres that the model gives you. The model tries to be factual. The assumptions have some flexibility. So now, Commissioner Stewart, we'll get into some of the history of the model. I just wanted to show people how it works and what we're seeing over time, which is kind of the fun part of this for me, is digging through that data. When we started the model, you have to remember the county's GIS was only 2 years old, and our first job was just to translate this concept into a model. We had to go find the databases. We had no aerial photos to QC these maps. A single model would use up almost 20% of our disk space, so we always overwrote the last one, and it would run all weekend long. That's what 3 days is, Friday morning through Monday morning. Remember, we did, what did I say, 17 of those, at least. From 1995 to 1999, we got to where we could run these annually, and we started improving the assessor's database to do a better job on the model. We started getting aerial photography flights so we could actually look at what the model was saying. In 1996, we got budget authority to buy a CD copier, which was a big deal because we started putting data on CDs, which is how we can go back in history because we went back to those CDs and put it back on our computers. And to put that in perspective, Google's celebrating its 15th anniversary. You know, that just seems like it's been there forever. But we're way before Google existed. In 2000, a group was formed to actually review the model and look at the aerial photography and the results, because there were problems with it. And they spent a lot of time ground-truthing it and fixing the model. The results were field-checked. We revised the model. Some of the things we found that mobile home parks were showing up as buildable. We found that we needed to increase the building values. So when I gave you those building value cutoffs of 13,000 and 67,500, they were set in 2000. And we also found these common area and courtyards were showing up as buildable, and those were taken out. And this is where we started looking at the underutilized. We've been through several iterations on some of that. In 2002, we started doing the historical models, so we could go back, what if we ran today's model in the past, what would that have done? We also started adding scenarios because the home builders, the cities, the CREDC all wanted their own versions of the model. So we started having scenarios so we could run different versions and compare results. And at that point, we were down to the models only taking about 8 hours to run. So we could run them in a day. So the big changes then in 2003 through 2005 was Commissioner Stanton said we need better data for the model, and she really led the charge for us to go out and get better data. And part of that was she wanted a better parcel layer, she wanted better slopes, and we pushed that into better wetlands. So back in the day, our parcel layer, as you know, is based on that map up there. We've carried it along and put it in the GIS and started overlaying it on roads or aerial photography. And suddenly you're saying, okay, that doesn't line up so well. So we went through a process of adjusting these. Now, it looks like maybe we adjusted them to the photography, but that's not true. We went out and surveyed the land and redid the whole map. That's based on better control. So that was a big change. The other thing we did was we did a LIDAR flight, which is a plane flying over, shooting a laser down, measuring the elevation of the land. The goal was to improve our slopes. Prior to that, our slopes were based on the soil maps. Now, this is the Mount Vista area. This is WSUV over here. So you can see the pink is what we would used to say was the critical slopes area. When we used the new LIDAR data, this is what our new slopes layer looked like. Again, the pink is what is considered critical, and the other things, the other colors are just close. With that, you can see the old stuff is in yellow, so we used to overstate our slopes in a lot of areas. but in other places we were understating our slopes. And as you step back, you can see a lot of areas where we were overstating slopes that people could build in, and other places we were completely missing slopes that would impact development. So this improving the quality of the data really helps the model be more realistic. The next thing we did is kind of independent of this. Public Works got a grant from the Department of Ecology to improve our wetlands layer. And we used that LIDAR data, a new soils layer. We had a collaborative effort with the wetland scientists from the county, the state, and the private sector to come up with a wetlands inventory we all agreed on. Now, prior to that, the blue area on here is our new wetlands. The red is the National Wetlands Inventory. So you can see we added a lot of wetlands. And to be fair, our model does also include hydric soils, which is a proxy for wetlands. But you can see the hydric soils actually adds other areas. And this is, again, it's overstated and understated. One of the big drivers for better wetlands is actually this portion of battleground in here, where we were saying this is all prime, vacant, buildable lands, and the development community is coming in. We're not saying we're not getting the yields. We're not even close to getting the yields we're supposed to get out here. So the development community was one that was really pushing us to get better wetlands in the system, because even though we weren't showing them, they still couldn't go out and build there, even though we didn't show a wetland, because they'd go on the ground and the wetland scientists would say, this is too wet to build there. So this really helped our model, and it's actually been a big boon to throughout the county that we have a better idea about where our wetlands are. Another part of the 2005 review is we actually now had enough history we could look at how well are our predictions actually playing out on the ground. And this is really where we said the underutilized just was not working and switched to this building value per acre. We also changed commercial underutilized to building value per acre. We also found this notion of assessed width, which a lot of big developments, like the classic is the cost of the Winco up on 99th Street. It sits on like six properties. And the parking lots kept coming up as vacant and the building is built. So the reason is the assessor says all these properties are tied to one. And so we had to say, okay, all these properties that are tied to one need to act like the one. They can't act independent. We also got into the notion that we excluded all the exempt properties because we said that's school property and it's not going to develop. Well, that threw out the whole Port of Vancouver. So we had to start looking at how to deal with the port as an exempt property and its own classifications. And down here, finally, Mr. Stewart, your environmental constraints are independent of the parcel configuration. And we'll start with that. Well, a couple things. One, when we did our review in 2005, what we actually looked at was, okay, here's what the vacant lands model said would develop, and here's what was actually developing. And what we said was, this red part will not develop. And what we found, the rate of development of our vacant lands, it was going to consume the whole thing by the time the 20-year plan was up. There was nothing left. When we looked at vacant critical, our old idea was critical doesn't develop. That's kind of a simple model. And what we're finding, well, that's not true. We were finding the critical lands were dropping out of the model. They were converting to something. Same thing with underutilized. And again, underutilized critical was the real problem. These lands were developing. And the same thing happened on the commercial properties where the critical was developing. And actually, we really found that on commercial property, a lot of the critical was developing. The critical was not really a constraint to development on these big properties. Some examples are the Costco over here in Hazeldale, the Legacy Hospital, the Walmart, the Target, all that stuff in Hazeldale all sits on what we were calling environmentally constrained. Now, one of the interesting facets of that is when the transportation planners were looking at 134th Street and looking at the vacant lands model, they said it's all critical. This area is going to develop really slowly. In fact, it exploded, and the stuff they did at 134th Street, which was supposed to last a long time, did not last very long. So you kind of see the notion of the vacant lands model and the work we do is the foundation of transportation planning in the county, parks planning. So this is a foundational piece. If we get it wrong, it kind of steers everybody else wrong too. Then we get to the notion of environmental constraints should be independent from the parcel configuration. This was a real problem. In the old model, remember, vacant in blue, critical, would never develop. And actually, this is a mansion and condo, an underutilized one. Where again, we said this was a mansion. It was a really expensive house on a big piece of land. It would never develop. But we kind of noticed that it did split out and go back into the model. And what we're finding with the first runs of the model is they say, wait a minute, vacant lands are increasing. How's that happening? And what we're finding is parcel reconfiguration was really changing the number of acres in the model. And you can see this parcel reconfiguration up here, where we used to say 50% of the parcel has critical, it was not going to build at all. And that just didn't make sense. And as we started, we keep seeing these reconfigurations happening and changing the amount of vacant land, and it was maddening. We just couldn't get a stable graph. And you can see how the critical land overlays with the parcel and how they start reconfiguring it. And in fact, they start to reconfigure it to actually set aside some of the critical areas to be open space or wetlands mitigation in their own separate parcels. Okay, so that's the 50% then. The next problem we had was the underutilized. And in the past, we used to say that underutilized kind of fell in a range depending on the property size and the zoning. And it just wasn't working for us. So what we said was, let's just get a bell curve of all the building value per acre for all the residential property inside the UGA. And then we picked a cutoff line, which is that 20% underutilized cutoff with the revised model. So we could see it visually, it made more sense, it's simpler to interpret. So this really seemed to do a much better job of handling the underutilized. So the result of that 2005 study, which was a lot of work and a lot of iterations of that, is we simplified the underutilized to that single building value per model. What's really cool about having it is for that year, so it automatically adjusts for inflation. It compensates for the, it worked on the acreage subdivisions, because what we were finding is you had a subdivision with 1 acre properties, depending on the size of the house, they would be popping in and out of the model. And this really fixed that. They stayed out of the model. It really works in the expansion areas, which before we were adding all this land and we weren't getting any more developable land because there were farms and houses and farms on the land. The easements and infrastructure, we did a really big study of how much right-of-way and easements were actually in residential subdivisions, because there were guesses or estimates all the way up to 30-40% of the land was being turned into infrastructure. And some of that, you know, we were looking at big picture, and we'd say that I-5 and 205 were infrastructure. Well, we're probably not going to build another infrastructure like that again. We need to focus on the infrastructure that's actually related to that development. And then the environmental constraints, really switching away from the parcel one really compensated for the mapping limitations. And it's based on the development patterns. So you start to see the environmental stuff much clearer when I do those maps where you zoom back through the model. It just is much easier to see. In 2007, we had that last comprehensive plan adopted. So if we look at 2013, where we're sitting today, what are the remaining model issues? I think the biggest issue for me is the fixed values. We have not changed those since 2000, I think it was. We also have the building value per acre is locked in at $50,000 per acre. One change we could do is try and make those act independently, because we can't change those until the commissioners say change them. And then you go to, well, what should we change them to? And it gets to be a big political thing, and be much better to, I think, get the bell curve, get some numbers, and have it automatically increment as we get a better result. Considerations that I, going through the models here, so we did this historical model, and I was going back, showing you the graphs. I was just playing with the data, looking at it. These frequent comprehensive plan changes are kind of masking the development. That's new since we did the 2005 model. The comprehensive plan from 94 to 2004 didn't change because it was the comprehensive plan. But that's just out there. The other thing that gets brought up a lot is redevelopment. The vacant lands really just looks at vacant or underutilized property that can be subdivided or redeveloped. Subdivided and developed. There's definitely a notion of redevelopment where you can tear down a building and build a bigger building with higher densities. And the city of Vancouver is very interested in that, and the model does not address it. It's just a vacant lands model. So that's an issue out there. So today, the model runs in under an hour on our new computers, which is awesome. And we have rerun all 17 models, some of them several times, in order to put together that little movie of battleground so that you can see the change in there and make sure they're all consistent. One of the things we see with the vacant lands model is we worked really hard in 2004, 2005 to do all this work. Then we all go, we're done with that. And we just run an annual thing every year and publish the numbers. We don't really do a thorough investigation. So this past month, I got to get all that stuff, get dusted off, and start running again and see what's happening and find out why that stuff's happening. So that's been exciting. The other thing we've done this year that's really neat is we're trying to put a lot more of this information out on the web. The web tools have gotten better. We're publishing more stuff on the web. And we've really put together a really cool page for sharing this information. And actually, as you said, there's no paper. No, it's online. I want to show you where that is. This site is currently... PowerPoint hung right there at the end of my presentation. Okay, so this is our new comprehensive growth management plan site. And this has all the information we showed there. Some of the, we showed those yield reports, they're here. Very exciting. It also has a new comprehensive plan map viewer. Now the map viewer is this. It's using our latest, greatest maps online, which is pretty cool. But we tried to put in all the layers here that pertain to the vacant livable lands model as we've used it over the years. So they can turn on the comprehensive plan if they want. It has the environmental constraints, so you can turn on all the critical areas. Or you can just say, what are the component pieces of it? Just like any of the other, this new Maps Online is a lot like the old Maps Online and how it behaves. It does move smoother, but still you can do an identify on any one of these layers. Select the active layer, and then you click on the map. It will show you the results over there. This is in test. This is only available inside the county right now because we are testing it. But it is out there for people to use. It should be showing the info down here. Demos.
When do you expect to go live with it?
That's up to Oliver and the commissioners, really. That, you know, we've tested it and you guys are on board that it works well enough, then we will put it out on the internet. Really, then I can click on these and see the. So this is kind of cool because it is showing our new mapping site. And that's on there from here. The other thing that's really cool is I've been showing you these really fun movies. We have those all online now. So I can go here and I can pick any city I want. I want to pick Washougal, for example. You can step through Washougal. That's pretty neat. You can see the years. We can also move it into a before and after mode. So I can say I want to compare 1996 to 2013. And you can see I can swipe back and forth.
That's cool. Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
If we go to the... what I like about Washougal is they're one of the areas really affected by the partial adjustment. If you look at between 2004 and 2005, you can see the map shift as we adjusted our parcel layer. That's pretty cool. You'll see that 2004-5 time change, the parcel layer adjustment throughout the county. There's all, unfortunately, Vancouver doesn't play well. It's got to be in four pieces. And I think where we'd like to go is where this ends up in the map, where you can actually see all the historical stuff on the map and do some more of the stuff on the map. But really, at least let you see the data that we've shown you today. Also online that we have is the detailed discussion of how the model works if you want to learn more. We also have all of the hard work that community planning has put into place on their page, which has even more page, more documentation. We have the annual population employment capacity reports and finally principal maps for the PDF of each of the UGAs and the current plan. And the notion here is this is kind of a new page where we say, you know what, everything we know about the comprehensive plan and DBLM process, we want to put in a central resource for you on a central web page. If there's more stuff you want to see out there, let us know. We want to add it there. I think some of the charts I've been showing today probably are worthwhile getting out there, and we can probably put together more of those. But those are currently one-offs for this presentation.
Bob, this really looks great. Why would we delay in releasing this to the world?
Because I'm letting you, the commissioner, see it first today.
This is Bob Wood. Bob would have already gone live 100 times ago, but he's being nice to us.
That's right. And we're still the big. We can go live with it. There's no problem. One of the interesting things is it does release our new mapping site, which we are definitely debugging. It is a little bit quirky right now, so we do like to release these things internally for testing. But we could say it's beta and put it out there, and if it crashes, we all understand it's beta.
Are you confident putting it out?
Oh yeah.
Let's do it.
Sounds good.
All right.
Yeah. Full speed ahead, sir.
And do you want to say it, or should I, as far as putting this information on the grid, Dave?
It's automatic now, right?
No, it should be automatic at this point. That we have the grid of information that's kind of a centralized source for citizens to be able to get information about what we're doing, and so making sure that the link directly to this is contained within the work session materials that's on the grid would be important.
Yeah, why don't we also, because this is like next generation, this is great what you've done here. Let's make it obvious on our home page that, hey, we got some very powerful tool available, and now that citizens most likely be very interested. And just make that really visible on the home page as an announcement, an icon or something.
That's a good point. Okay. Yeah, we don't take enough credit a lot of times for kind of the next generation stuff that you do, Bob, or that, you know, that we do in this county. It's a great point to kind of really call that out.
Great job.
Bob, thank you. Oliver, what else?
I think, well, I've done a good job, and this is something that we in planning department do with GIS. So it's a joint effort. GIS maintains the model. We work with the cities. I see some of my partners here. Each year we provide them with the outcome or output of the model and ask them to weigh in, to review it, and provide us feedback. As Bob indicated, it is available to the public. The Responsible Growth Forum relies on it. The building industry relies on it. So this is a partnership. Often we get into some of the other issues we discuss, how much will be, you know, set aside for infrastructure, or how much will we say will develop or not develop, and how do we account for redevelopment, something outside the model. That's when you see the cities coming up and showing you how much more we can add to the model that is not available. So this is more to help the board understand how the model works, because you're going to hear us often say, here's how much is available. It is based on this model.
So why don't you, kind of, that's a good wrap up as far as how this information plays into what we are just starting with our comp plan update, legally and functionally.
What I would say is that the next work session with the commissioners, I haven't set that up, but I'm working on the material for that, will be on the board picking a population number and employment. When the board makes that decision, we will use this model, working with our local jurisdiction, to populate, okay, what is the capacity, what is the holding capacity based on the DBLM, and then from there we can begin discussion, do we need to expand the boundary, or do we need, what else do we need to do? So that's the relationship to the board understanding this model. That's what we'll do next.
And legally, we have to have a 20-year land supply.
We have to legally have a 20-year land supply.
So this helps us know how much holding capacity we have in the existing boundaries, using as, you know, advanced data as we possibly can to match with reality.
Yes.
And then from that and figuring out how many more people and jobs we expect, we figure out how many more, you know, how much more land we need.
That's correct.
Okay. Cool. Other questions about this?
No, good
stuff.
Job.
As always, Bob, cool stuff, man.
Great job, Bob.
Yeah, appreciate it. All right. Good. And we're 5 minutes early.
That's all right. I wasn't expecting any decision today, as I said earlier. So this is more informational tutorial. I'm glad that I see some members of the planning commission here, because often this goes before them, before it gets to the board. So
no doubt. Yeah, thanks for being here. Appreciate it. All right. Excellent. We're done. Then we're done with this. I think we have 11 a.m. Mark, do we have an 11 a.m. board session?
11:15.
11:15.
Yeah.
Yeah, 11:15.
Property tax is delinquent.
Delinquent property.